You ever get the feeling that everything in America is completely up?
They're saying I should think stuff. They're saying
something is wrong with me.
How did you get to be so cynical?
Practice.
All right, it is the second week of August, which means Eric Bennett is back joining me for another edition of... We still have to come up with a title for this
series. We'll come up with it.
It'll be there eventually. You can hit us up on Twitter or hit me up at ChatSmartin. Give me a title suggestion. This is a series looking at different elements of pop culture, mostly movie, I think related is how we're kind of planning out the next couple of series, but it's a work in progress, so we'll get to it. But anyway, Eric is back with me. Eric, first, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Last month, I think we got a lot of good response and interest in the Comic-Con preview episode.
Mm.
And I know, unfortunately, I did not have a chance to make it down there. Tickets that I thought were going to come through did not. And then I was just like, I spent so much time outside that week previous due to some work extracurriculars that I was like, I don't feel like going down to San Diego and just walking around outside for 8 hours.
Yeah.
Because it was a little hot that weekend.
Yeah, it was a little warm. So, but it got cool about 5 or 6. Mm-hmm. Other years it's kind of stayed hot, so it was nice.
But if you could give us just a wrap up, because I know, you know, before you were saying that this year wasn't a very high expectation year with Marvel not being there, HBO not being there. What, now that you went, you spent all 5 days, what was your experience like, and how would you rank this with the other 13 times that you've been there?
Well, yeah, it's a great question. I think we had talked about how, you know, you just mentioned that this might be a dud. Like, where's the big, you know, the biggest studio of them all? And everyone's wondering if DC could carry the room in Hall H because Marvel wasn't there. Everybody was worried about Walking Dead carrying the room the day before because Game of Thrones wasn't there. So, objectively speaking, it was definitely a down year in the terms of offsites and Hall H and some of the panels because the big dogs weren't there. But what that did is it allowed you to do more social things, and the offsite stuff was incredible, and the nightlife was incredible, and the smaller panels were fun, and the shopping was fun. I think the shopping and the exhibitors and the artists was an all-time high. So you kind of borrow time from those big things that weren't there and you lend them to other things that you wish you could get to when the big things aren't there. So I did listen to the SDCC blog, which I really recommend, for their take on it. And they had their highlights and lowlights, and it really echoed a lot of what I went through. They said it was a weird year just because there wasn't that thing that everybody was talking about. But then it was a great year because you could get into everything you wanted to get into. So for me, we did a Ready Player, and I don't know how much you want me to get into this because it's a lot of details, but I think for a good overview, it would be the Ready Player One offsite. We only waited 20 minutes, and then there was a Tomb Raider offsite, and they had a gigantic snake that was like 30 feet long, and we got to meet that guy and take a picture. And it was like a lot of just walking into stuff and walking in and meeting people, and it was like that the whole convention. So it was a very stress-free, entertaining, relaxing convention. We decided one night to throw a party in our hotel room, which was something we haven't done before. We bumped into a guy in an elevator who got us into Conan O'Brien, 2 days where we had struck out completely even before we showed up to getting tickets at all. So all of a sudden, we're in the best offsite in San Diego, running into a guy in an elevator. And that's the kind of the mystery and the magic of San Diego Comic-Con, is that it's the unscripted stuff is always the best. I've said this before. So the scripted stuff wasn't there. The unscripted stuff was off the charts. And it was fun, wall to wall. The one thing that I personally geeked out on that was Comic-Con related was the Godzilla trailer, which I'm a huge Godzilla fan, seen all 30 plus movies, whatever it is. And it was like 10 times better than I thought it would be. Now, the crowd wasn't as into it as I was. That was sandwiched in between the new J.K. Rowling movie, Crimes of Grindelwald, or something like that.
The Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them
sequel. Yeah, I think it's like the Crimes of Grindelwald, but yeah, it's a Fantastic Beasts sequel. And then there was the DC stuff, which was really interesting to see how they were going to do that. So I was in Hall H for the DC thing, the J.K. Rowling Fantastic Beasts presentation and the Godzilla thing, which blew me away. And that was really the only panel I went to. And apparently Hall H was walk-in every day. I didn't need to hire someone the night before, but I did anyway. So it was really less about the convention and more about having fun. And that's why I would rank this at a, it actually, now I'm going to have to recorrect myself. It has been 14 years, not 13. I said 14, then 13, now it's 14. I would put this in the top five because of how much fun was had. And the fun went till 2 or 3 in the morning every day or every night. So that was, that's why I just can't recommend going there enough, because even if the convention seems flat, it never is when you get there. Something will always come out of nothing. Just weird stuff happens there.
And did you get your Big Trouble in Little China vinyl?
I did, but I did it on eBay after I got back. So it was impossible. Like, the Mondo booth is supposedly impossible to get anything past preview night. I didn't have tickets for preview night, so by the time you, which is a Wednesday, so if you go Thursday, I had three friends trying to get it for me. On preview night, failed. Thursday, sold out. So then I got home and I got upset, but I hadn't done much shopping. So I went on eBay and I paid $80 for a $40 record, which I didn't consider that bad. So I actually have it, but I had to get it on eBay.
Gotcha.
It came in perfect shape. It's exactly what I wanted. And got about 2 or 3 other things shopping-wise. A lot of stuff I didn't want to get. So I didn't actually spend as much money as I thought, but I got what I wanted.
Okay. Sounds like a decent time. And when does the planning for San Diego 2019 start taking place?
It's always... They always say when WonderCon tickets go on sale, then they start talking about... Because WonderCon is kind of like the thing... It's run by the same company, CCI. So when WonderCon occurs, I believe that's in April of next year, there's talks about registration probably in the fall where you have to put your name in. We're already registered anyway. So it's usually like 5 to 6 months after this, you have to kind of gear up for tickets for the next one. And then I create a group on Facebook, you'll be on it, and then we'll talk about, let's all pool together and try to get each other badges. And the whole madness starts cycling back up. And yeah. We're all excited for 2019, based on this year.
Yeah, this year, again, you know, you start planning it, and I go, no, I'm not going to go. If I go, I'll end up trying to go down for like a Saturday, figure out a way to go down. And then when you get down there and I start seeing the photos and everything that's going on, I'm always like, I need to go. Just next year, I'm going to go. And it's, I mean, Kevin Huntsberger of the My 1-2-3 Cents podcast, we always talk, we're the same way with our WrestleMania trips. Now that we're not going every year like we used to, it's when we start hearing the stories come out and seeing the picture, like, maybe we should think about next year, maybe. So, I don't know. I think it's been a while since I've had a good Comic-Con experience. So maybe next year will be the full immersion. And I'm trying to get Kevin and a couple other guys to come out and experience it. So we'll see.
Now I noticed on your net, on the Jittery Monkey Network, there's somebody that talks about Comic-Cons and pop culture. Is that Kevin?
No, that's Greg Mahochko.
Does he go to Comic-Con?
He has been to the Cape Girardeau, Missouri Comic-Con.
Okay.
And I think he's been to one in St. Louis, I want to say, possibly. But yeah, Greg is the founder of the Jittery Monkey. He's the one that gave me my job here.
Okay.
It sends me my paycheck every month, supposedly. And but I'm trying to get him to come out and go, but he, I don't know, after listening to our show, he did a show talking about, his thoughts on Comic-Con, and after hearing about the 100,000 people showing up, he's like, maybe that's a little too much. I don't know if I can, but we'll see.
Well, the thing I would highly recommend is that, you know, going there so many years is that there's a way you can do it that would tailor a lot of different people. Now, if you're afraid of big crowds and waiting in lines, it may not be the best place in the world for you to be, but the thing I'd be kind of excited about if you went there is that we kind of know the ins and outs of it, and we have connections now, which kind of circumvents a lot of these problems that you would have if you just showed up and like, oh, I'm going to do the Comic-Con. I haven't been here in a while. Mm-hmm. Well, where would you go? What lines would you be in? What are the waits? So we've kind of gamed it to where we can, within about an hour or two of waking up, figure out what the day is going to look like and get pretty close to hitting those marks. And I know my wife and my friend Larry, who I went to the Comic-Con with, they were at the Jack Ryan experience, and I could just feel it wasn't what I wanted, and we had been waiting, I think, 90 minutes, and I start hitting this threshold where I'm like, you got to pull the cord. You got to say, you know what, guys, I'm going to bail out of this. I'll meet up with you later. And then you start seeking out other options on your list. So I think if you went down there, we could show you kind of how to navigate this to where you're having a good time. This could be people that we know down there. This could be you know, we would get text messages and invitations and emails, and it would just change our whole night. I know one really special experience is that Johnny, she loves the Doug Loves Movie podcast, and I photoshopped, with her help, a sign of Johnny Dangerously using her name, which is J-O-N-N-I, and then we changed all the faces to be Doug Benson and all those other people, and it was kind of her dream to see one of the podcasts in person, as far as like something she's always wanted to do, and she wanted them just to notice her sign, and then they picked her sign, and then out of hundreds of people, she won. And then she met all of them and won all the loot.
Oh, nice.
So that's the type of thing that happens down there, or can happen down there, is just random kind of stuff where you're interfacing with people in the industry. So everyone down there is a comic book or aspiring writer, director. We're hanging out with a director down there. It could be, we were at a bar one night, and the guy, that one of the main actors in Westworld, like, offered me his table. That's littered all throughout San Diego Comic Con. Like I said, if you do it proper from 8 in the morning till 3 in the morning, it's this fantastic series of kind of random things. And that's what you're talking about with those photos. So if you look at the schedule, you could be like, this isn't the best year that I've been to. Then when you get down there, you're like, oh, it's got that magic. It's always, and no other convention rivals it. It's not even close. This would be 10 times of a WonderCon, 10 times of an Emerald City. So, yeah, I think you need to visit. I think you'd be very surprised and happy with it.
All right. Well, Greg and Kevin, if you're listening, make plans next year to come out.
Come on down. We'll show you around.
We also talked real quick. I have two more points to ask about before we get into this week's topic or this month's topic. And that is, you know, we discussed the Chris Hardwick situation and how, if that would have an aura over Comic-Con. Did you notice anything? Were people talking about it? Was it, I don't know if he did the Walking Dead panel or anything that he was supposed to do.
Well, yeah, actually, there was a moment that we had in Hall H, and the only time we were in Hall H, Chris Hardwick would have been there, and that was when Aisha Taylor was substituting him for the DC and Warner Brothers panel, because that would be the biggest panel of them all, and it was the biggest panel of them all. She was absolutely fantastic. In fact, I turned to my wife and said, if she, not out of any political correctness, I said, if they just decided to go with her, just based on how she's doing, she, like, I've seen Hardwick, I don't know, 5-10 years in a row, whatever it is. He's great. He's kind of the same thing every time, as far as being a really smooth host and kind of a funny guy. She was incredible. And she knew some of the people that were on the stage for DC, and she did a great job. So I think based on that, and I think Yvette Nicole Brown did a great job doing The Walking Dead. She's the Walking Dead super fan. In fact, some people want her to just replace Chris Hardwick on the Talking Dead show. Apparently she hit it out of the park. So I would think, if there's a cloud hanging over them, I mean over Hardwick, and you have them in the wings, you could just kind of substitute them. Maybe Hardwick can just take less of a role with the Comic-Con. So there was no cloud that I could, no one was talking about it. I think because those guys knocked it out of the park, there was just, these guys were great. I don't know if we talked or if it had happened that he was reinstated.
No, that came out
After our podcast.
Yeah.
That is a topic of conversation online that I've really been following. It's still a real air of mystery on how he's going to approach his first show. Is he going to apologize? Is he going to talk about, you know, domestic issues and how women are treated? No one knows how that's going to go. And my support for him is still there. I do believe innocent until proven guilty. And we'll see how that plays out. But to answer your question, I don't think it affected the Comic-Con one bit. And because of those really talented women that came in and knocked out of the park, I might want to see them again. I would enjoy it.
Okay. And the other news that broke during Comic-Con, and Kevin and I talked about this on episode 53 of Positive Cynicism, which, as Eric and I are recording this episode, has not aired yet, so Eric has not had the chance to hear our conversation, but we were discussing James Gunn being fired from Guardians of the Galaxy. Did that permeate through, because that would have happened, I believe, on the Friday of Comic-Con.
Yeah.
Did that, I mean, did everybody know?
Yeah, everybody that we talked to, that was brought up. It didn't, I don't think, again, because the Comic-Con is split 100,000 ways and Marvel wasn't there to begin with anyway. There was no weirdness attached to the actual convention, because I think he was supposed to be at the Marvel booth doing an Infinity War surprise signing, and maybe he didn't show up. I didn't hear if he showed up or not. I know that every time he went to a bar or restaurant, it was like a topic of conversation. And it seemed like every single person, probably unsurprisingly around these fan bases, were in support of James Gunn. And I had kind of a recent epiphany where I just said, and this absolutely destroys me as a fan, a rabid fan of Guardians of the Galaxy and Marvel movies in general, that I'm boycotting the movie. I'm not really a boycott guy, generally speaking, but and especially that movie, which is kind of like my heart, the heart and soul of the Marvel Universe. I just think he got jobbed so bad on that. It's, if you can't stand up for the good people, then who are you going to stand up for? And by all accounts, we don't know him. Mm-hmm. Only people that work with him or his girlfriend or his family really knows him. I would say the same for Chris Hardwick. But if you've read anything about James Gunn, he's not the person that some people were saying, you know, that he might be. And these things were taken totally out of context a long time ago. Obviously a joke. Okay, poor jokes, whatever. I read him and I didn't even understand what he was getting at. So I don't think it really affected the Comic-Con, but it's really kind of upset the Marvel Universe, and I signed a petition for Disney to reinstate him. I'm reading these horrible articles that they're probably not going to. I really wish the cast, I don't know if you saw their letter that they released.
Yeah.
I was a little disappointed with that letter. I posted it on Facebook out of support for James Gunn, and I like some of the things they said in the letter, but much like social media does, there's just like a lot of slacktivism. There's a lot of talk. But if you're an NFL team or an NBA team or the cast of Guardians of the Galaxy, and you don't believe in something the ownership is doing or the management's doing, don't show up. Don't go to work. Sit on the sidelines and go, I'm going to sacrifice my career for this. That's what Kaepernick did. Right or wrong, you have your own opinions on it. But he paid a price, and he said, I'm going to speak my mind. Now, with James Gunn, if the cast shows up for work for the Guardians of the Galaxy 3 and gets their residuals and their $20 million checks, what does this letter mean? We back our friend except for when it comes to the sequel? I mean, so to me, the letter should have been, you know, we'll see what happens, but right now, we feel like this journey has to be taken with James. That sentence is left off that message that they sent out, and to me, that's very glaring. So I personally won't see the movie. I'll still support Marvel movies. There's a lot of good creators, but James Gunn's the best of the best. So I'm not rolling with Guardians if he's not there. It's dead to me. I don't even want to hear about it.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like I said, you can go back, check out episode 53, where Kevin and I have an hour-long discussion about James Gunn and a lot of other recent celebrities, I guess, getting in trouble for things they did in the past, and as we as a country or society need to let people grow and forgive and move on. And that's not saying everybody is right, but or any behavior is okay, but people should have a chance to apologize and move on. But you can listen to that. As far as Eric and I, we're going to move into a topic that, you know, we were talking before we went on, started recording, that this series, the topics we choose are so broad that there's so much information here. So hopefully we can, in the next 40 minutes, kind of comprise our thoughts. But we're going to be looking at the rise of sequels in Hollywood.
In a world where nothing is new, a recycled plot and action is coming to a theater near you. Hear all the jokes you liked the first time again. Marvel at bigger explosions and more action sequences. No need for exposition. Hollywood blockbuster movie.
And I think a Marvel, talking about Marvel right before this is a good segue, because right now Marvel is probably the biggest franchise going, and you know, you just had Ant-Man and Wasp come out 3-4 weeks ago as we record this, and Avengers Infinity War, and I believe there's like 19 Marvel movies in the last 10 years.
Yeah, at least.
So let's start. I don't even fully know where to start, but just to give a bit of context, I guess. I was looking through Box Office Mojo has a yearly box office chart. And so I went back to 1980, because I figured that's, with our age group, that's kind of the start of our formative cinema years.
Yeah.
You know, granted, the 70s were a little bit the tail end with Star Wars and everything coming in, but 1980 being the fact that that was the biggest movie that year was Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah.
Probably one of the biggest sequels of all time. The top 10 list from 1980 included two sequels. Do you know what the other one was besides Empire Strikes Back off the top of your head?
I'll tell you. I don't want to take too much time to tell me.
It's Smokey and the Bandit 2.
Oh, I wouldn't have gotten that.
Okay, then I jumped ahead to 1983 because Return of the Jedi came out. In 1983, the only other movie, or there were two other films that you could put into sequel-itis, I guess, if you wanted. But I'm not familiar with these series to know, and we were talking about this a little bit before. Mm-hmm. Number 7 was Sudden Impact, which was a Dirty Harry movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But I don't know if those movies actually carry on a storyline or if they are individual stories.
Yeah, I don't think there's a lot of continuity, but I would consider it a sequel. It's okay. Just more of the same.
More of the same. And then number 6 was Octopussy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so, again, we were discussing about the James Bond series. I know the Daniel Craig films carry more of a sequel storyline throughout them. I don't know about the Sean Connery and the Roger Moore films, if they are sequels or just continuing stories.
I think it'd be an interesting podcast. The James Bond thing I've never really fully understood, and I'd be kind of negative if I talked about it, because I'm pretty underwhelmed by what I see on the in that series. But then there's this diehard group of fans that love it, and they just want a million of them, which is what I want for Marvel. So if you ever did a podcast with a James Bond fan or expert, I'd like to hear it.
Because
I want to know what is the allure of this series after like 20 or 30 of them, because I don't see it.
I know there is a James Bond podcast out there. I'm sure there are many, but there's at least one really popular one that breaks down every film with super fans. And I know Mike DeKalb, who shows up here every month on Wonder Why, is a huge James Bond fan.
That'd be so cool. Maybe you talk to him about that. I'd like to hear that.
All right. Anyway, moving on. Let's go up to the start of 1990, just randomly for no apparent reason other than the fact that it's the start of a decade. And again, you have one movie in the top 10 that year that's a sequel, and that's Die Hard 2, Die Harder. And then I went ahead to 1999, which, continuing on the Star Wars theme, you have Phantom Menace that came out that year. And then we see, at number 3, we had Toy Story 2, and number 4, Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me.
Mm.
So again, we're still less than half of the top 10 being sequels. Now you jump ahead to 2017, so I'm going to save some time and not go through year by year. And out of the top 10 films, the exception of It, which is a remake based off, you know, there was a television movie that came out in 1990-91, and then you have Justice League, which we kind of said could be technically a sequel to Batman v Superman.
It's a continuation of the story for sure. Right.
And then Wonder Woman, which is a spinoff of, well, it's a spin into, I guess, of to Justice League, because it came out before Justice League, but it does follow the same characters. But other than that, you have Last Jedi. Well, Beauty and the Beast is a remake. Jumanji is a reboot. Then Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, Spider-Man Homecoming, another reboot. Thor 3, Despicable Me 3, and Justice League. So
wow, yeah.
We're looking at now, and for sake of argument, let's just jump into, we're halfway through 2018, a little over halfway. The top 10 movies so far, and this will obviously change, the only movie, the bottom three, number 10, Ready Player One, number 9 is Ocean's 8, which is a reboot,
mm-hmm.
sequel, number 8 is A Quiet Place, the one of the few actual original pieces of material to come out, and then your top 7, Ant-Man and Wasp, Solo, Deadpool 2, Jurassic World, Incredibles 2, Avengers Infinity War, Black Panther.
Wow.
So again, I mean, Black Panther and Solo, you can say, are standalone original first films, but they all play off of other existing films.
Yeah, I was kind of bringing up a point. It definitely isn't a proper use of the word sequel, but I think all these movies like It that are called reboots, mm-hmm. I consider them sequels because they're piggyback. Now, look, they're not going forward in time like a sequel does, mm-hmm. or prequel like Phantom Menace and all that, but they're still piggybacking on a built-in audience. So that gimmick is built in. So if you have Die Hard or Dumb and Dumber and it goes back in time or forward in time, they're still playing off of the name of the franchise. So maybe sequel wouldn't be the proper word maybe for the podcast. I'm not going to change it now, but like we could talk about franchising. So you're not talking about launching something original. You're talking about launching something where everyone knows what's going on. And that's the allure of it. It's either, oh, this movie goes back in time. I want to see how it got up to where I'm at now. Or it's going forward. I want to see how the characters progress. It's the same shtick. It just runs in different directions. So all these movies, I think, whether you're positive or cynical, to use your podcast title, it depends on how you look at that. And then we're going to get into that. But I think all these movies are in the exact same, like, barrel, you know, whether or not they go forward or back.
Mm-hmm. And just to point out real quick, in 2018, apparently, there are 53 movies that are sequels or reboots.
Oh.
That is more than one a week per average. And that's, you know, I think for me, this is, we've had this discussion before, this is why I've stopped going to the theater as often, because I feel like I've already seen a movie before I even see it. And so unless it's a series that I really like the new Mission Impossible, which I have not seen yet, but I will probably go see just because I liked the previous five of the movies. I have not seen part three. But, you know, we talked about this with Marvel movies where I just got so burnt out on seeing the same thing over and over.
Yeah.
And they kind of reset at the beginning again because you have to continue on the story. And I think this is another distinction to make, and you can say it with the Star Wars franchise, or, you know, if we go back to the 70s, Godfather even, there's a difference in crafting a story and having a multi-arc story as opposed to just a sequel. And I would take this year Deadpool 2, for example, where to me it was like, even though they kind of expected Deadpool to be a franchise piece, or, you know, most likely would have a sequel given the fact that it's a superhero movie, they didn't really seem to have anything in place for the sequel to tell a continuing story.
That's a really good point, because I thought Deadpool 2 was a disappointment. Now they're playing off what I thought was a great first movie, low budget, and then they get a big budget and they kind of mess it up and they introduce a whole bunch of stuff, and then Deadpool's pushed in the background. And I agree, I don't think they had anything planned for it.
Other than
they borrowed from the comics, and they borrowed Cable and X-Force. There's something slightly funny there, but it did seem like they were riffing and it wasn't hitting for me. There was no real flow to that movie. I think one thing I would challenge you on a little bit is that to go to the movie theaters, there's plenty of movies. Mr. Rogers would be one.
Great film.
I know the original Sicario. I know there's a sequel to that I enjoyed. But you can go to the movie theaters and see all kinds of movies that are original. I think, again, I may have mentioned this, I don't know if the number's 400 or 500 or 600, something like that. But there's tons of movies that are put out. Eighth Grade is, like, doing really well. I love A24, by the way. They make nothing but original movies. So you could just make a feast off of A24. You could make a feast off documentaries. You could make, I just saw Annihilation, which is an A24 movie from Alec Garland. And that, or is it Alex? Whatever. That was a really, it's based on a book, but it's an awesome movie. It's one of my favorites. I just saw Don't Worry, He Won't Get Far on Foot with Joaquin Phoenix. Love that.
Oh, that's out already?
Yeah.
Oh.
And that's another A24 movie, I believe. But so if you're getting burned out on the sequels, the Star Wars, the Marvels, the Transformers, I know that in the summer it's a little tough to avoid it because that's like every single showing in the multiplex, but there's a lot of other stuff that you can read up on and seek out that might kind of restore your faith in movies.
And I think I'll jump off on that thought real quick. That's the problem that I have, another problem that I have with Hollywood right now, is there are all these smaller movies that are out there, but no one knows about them. You mentioned Eighth Grade. I only know of that because I saw the trailer when I saw the Mr. Rogers film. He Won't Get Far on Foot, I did actually see some online promotion for it. But these are films that, you know, they make these smaller films, but then they don't promote them. They just kind of throw them out there. And unfortunately, I think our audience, or the movie-going audience, wants to see, it's not that they want to see the same thing over and over again, but when you're paying $15, $20 for a film, you kind of want to know, like, am I going to like this movie? Is this going to be a good use of my time? And so you go back, you end up going back to what you know. And, you know, that's when, I know MoviePass right now is kind of a dead man walking company. But when they first came out, I had it and saw so many movies that I'd never heard of because I was seeing them essentially for free. And yes, those were the movies that I enjoyed 10 times more than the big budget Hollywood films. But now, if I have to pay for it, it's good. Am I going to risk spending the money and not on something that I don't know? Same reason why I don't go see a lot of plays.
Yeah.
You know, if I don't know it, it's kind of walking in blind. So I wish Hollywood would promote the smaller films a little bit better.
Yeah, I definitely think they could do a much better job with that. I know for myself personally, the summer is obviously the season of kind of dump movies, and then some studios dump movies there. I don't know if they're write-offs or what. What comes after summer is usually just horrifically bad. That's like where they dump the worst of the worst. And then obviously in the fall, they dump their Oscar bait movies. And then it's like, you know, someone, which is, don't worry, he won't get far on foot. I'm surprised that didn't come out in the fall. But by the way, it's one of my favorite movies of the year. I think one thing I like to do is I like to go on Netflix a lot. Mm-hmm. And going to the movie theater, I think I do reserve for those bigger experiences. Like you mentioned Mission Impossible. I'm actually going tonight. Okay. I didn't want to go at all. I didn't like the last two or three. I like the one with Philip Seymour Hoffman, and I like the first one.
Okay.
I couldn't stand the John Woo one. I couldn't stand the other Christopher McQuarrie one, which I think was that Ghost Protocol or Rogue Nation? It was something like that.
Yeah.
Then there's the one that Brad Bird did, and I couldn't stand that one.
Hmm.
But then all my friends are saying, no, this is the one to go to. So hopefully I won't get fooled on this one. But
and I think, I'll jump in real quick.
Yeah.
You make a good point. Like, that's the other thing is these blockbuster films are films that you kind of feel like the need to see on a big screen with great sound. Even though a lot of people do have home theater systems now, it's that spectacle of seeing it on the big screen. Whereas a movie like Eighth Grade or He Won't Get Far on Foot, do you need to see them on a big screen or watching them at home in a, you know, surrounding where you don't have to worry about someone being on their phone or talking or, you know, it's a more enjoyable experience.
I agree. And I think the problem is, and I think you bring up a legitimate issue, is that it's fine that you're going to see a movie that's action-packed on a big screen with good sound and with a big crowd. That's why I'm going for these Marvel movies. But the thing is, if a sameness sets in, and by definition, all the movies we're talking about have a sameness to them, a consistency. Mm-hmm. Do you get burned out seeing the same type of story told over and over again? And that's what Marvel's going to have to confront. Except their box office kind of says otherwise. So maybe people are being conditioned to kind of say, well, go to this movie and you're going to have a similar experience, which is generally speaking a pretty good time. Mm-hmm. And then in 6 months, we'll give you another shot of that. What I like so much, we disagree heavily on Last Jedi, is that that was a sequel, but then it was like throwing away everything that was done in the previous movie and trying new things, much to the behest of half the fan base, apparently. But I think with these big action movies, they probably need to roll the dice a little bit on something new once in a while, because if all the big films are sequels, we're kind of sitting there and half our experience is like, okay, I'm seeing Tom Cruise do this. That's what I'm a little bit worried about tonight, mm-hmm. is that I've seen him hanging off airplanes, I've seen him scream, he's been running so many times in this movie. I actually found out something really interesting. So Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible apparently is 4 or 5 years older than Wilford Brimley was in Cocoon. Did you hear that?
I've heard that, yeah.
That I've keeps echoing to, in my brain.
Yeah.
That is awesome. That's an awesome weird bit of trivia.
Allegedly, and I have not verified this, but when Sex and the City 2 was made, the cast was either the same age or just slightly older than the first season of The Golden Girls.
Whoa. I have to process that one. But I guess I know you're the host, but I'd ask you a question. Do you find this kind of franchising, it sounds like you're getting burned out on it, or you have been burned out on it?
I have been, and it's something that I have to look back, because we always look through the past with rose-colored glasses and say everything was better when I was a kid, or, you know.
It was, by the way.
Well, I tend to agree. But we look at, again, we grew up in the 80s, so that's the time frame that I'm going to kind of focus on right here. We had 7 Police Academy movies. You know, 6 or 7 Friday the 13th, 6 Nightmare on Elm Streets, Caddyshack 2, Short Circuit 2.
Halloween's,
Teen Wolf 2. We had cash grab sequels back then.
Back to the Futures, which were all freaking awesome.
Right.
For the most part.
So, yeah. So, sequels are not a new issue in Hollywood. But it seems like they're overshadowing the amount of original material. Because even if something isn't a sequel, now we're going to, what's the latest book craze? What's, you know, all these YA novels? Darkest Minds just opened. The series I'm not familiar with. I did see the film, and I think the target audience for that film will enjoy it. I am not in that target audience, so to me it was just more repetitive. It seemed very much like what I've seen out of the Divergent series, the Maze Runner series, Hunger Games. It's that originality aspect is what I am, because I like story. As a wannabe writer, I think it comes down to story first. I actually had this little back and forth on Twitter with a friend of mine who loved Mission Impossible and gave a shout out to Tom Cruise and said, oh, Tom, you know, thanks for another great Mission Impossible. And I was like, well, I think, you know, some credit has to go to Christopher McQuarrie, because a good movie starts with a good story.
And a director.
And a director. So, yeah, it takes more than one person to have a good film. But, you know, Hollywood, like I said, they're looking at, you know, numbers. What can we make the most money off of? And is a movie like Eighth Grade going to make $100 million, even if we promote it well? Or is another superhero movie going to make $1 billion worldwide?
Yeah, I think, and we talked about this, but I think the absolutely insane Chinese market and how they're eating up American movies and franchise movies, they are injecting so many hundreds of millions of dollars. That's why Marvel sends out their movie stars to China. And that's why they film alternate takes with Chinese actors. Like, so this emerging Asian and global market for movies, we never use the word dumbing down, but they're making these movies very broad, very conventional. They know it's hooking a global audience. They're not going to mess with the formula at that point. You're not going to get an original Marvel movie. Ant-Man would be a good example. I really enjoyed the new one. It plays pretty much like an American semi-blockbuster, and it's not doing great overseas, and it's not a surprise. Whereas if you make an Avengers movie, there's got to be something a global audience is going to latch onto. There's like 500 people in that movie. So I think that they're kind of covering their bets globally. And these tentpole films, as you know, is a way for them to... They have a finite amount of chips to push in as far as their budgets. And they're like, well, we can do some original movies over here. We know these ones work over here. And these sequels are generally bringing in a consistent amount of cash. And they're placing their bets like in Vegas. And they're just hoping these little ones pay off, the big ones really pay off. If these little ones don't pay off and the medium ones don't pay off, then they've got a big one to cover all those. And that's what Sony was doing with Spider-Man, is that would cover their losses on other movies. And what's happening, I think, which could be considered unfortunate, is that the budgets of the movies are so high that they can't take a chance. So if you're going to launch the next Spider-Man, you're going to launch the next Matrix, you're going to launch the next Star Wars movie, you're going to have to ask someone to write you a check for $150 million. They're never going to write you that check if you say, no one's heard of this movie, it's not based on a book, it's not based on a previous thing, we don't have 10 A-list actors in it. That's where we're at right now. And I think the only way you can combat that is by seeking out those smaller and medium-sized movies and use the Netflix platform. Use the Landmark Cinemas here in Los Angeles, because they show those Don't Worry, You Won't Get Far on Foot and Werner Herzog movies, and they show all art house films. So you can make a living off of that and just avoid... Chad, you might get to a point where you just write off every Marvel movie ever made. You might be at that point and say, I'm done with Star Wars. That's okay. You don't get anything out of it anymore. Yeah. You know, that's a real thing.
No, that's true. And this goes back to conversation we've been having for the last couple of years about my passion for film. And is it changing, or is it just dwindling because of the sameness, which, you know, I am out of every target demographic poll, I guess. But you make a good point too, where because these movies are so big, that the audience that they're aiming for covers all spectrums. Mm-hmm. It's you know, teenagers to 70-year-olds, male, female, professional, you know, non-professional. It's trying to...
8 to 80.
Yeah, it's throwing the kitchen sink in and saying someone's going to like something in this film, instead of having the niche films, which are still there. And I think, you know, you can look back again to the 80s, where you had these smaller budget or mid-budget films that would do well on home video. And even, you know, going back to Austin Powers in the sequel, Austin Powers didn't do well at the box office.
No, it didn't.
But then it, you know, gained traction on home video. And that's another issue that has died is with the streaming platforms. And yeah, you have Netflix and you have Amazon Prime and all these, but I don't know if movies are developing a following on the streaming platforms, because it's so much harder to find something than it was to go to a video store and pick something out.
No, totally.
And especially with Netflix promoting, you know, producing 100 films on their own each year, those are the movies they're going to be promoting, not the studio film that didn't, you know, do well.
Yeah, and there's a real danger in, like, genome programming, which is what Netflix is doing, and Spotify, and these streaming services do, which is they basically say, because you like these movies, we're going to just only recommend on a marquee the movies that you'll like.
Yeah.
This is the problem with Rotten Tomatoes, is that we're all kind of self-agreeing before things even come out, or self-hating in the case of Solo. And no one's, like, just showing up and... Like, so for me, I'll watch, like, a French film or a Russian film. I'll watch a documentary on the prison system. I went to Mr. Rogers. I'll go to Mission Impossible. I'll see a Marvel movie. I'll listen to classical music. I'll listen to rap music. I don't know if... It's like people are, like, they're catering what they want. The internet's catering what they already want. And this could be your problem with sequels, is that we're conditioning young kids, and I think these movies are very successful marketing to kids, and I enjoy them, but if little kids are just conditioned like Marvel movies, are they just going to expect everything to be like a Marvel movie? When they don't get it, they're disappointed. Well, how about they see something else, like eighth grade? I'm going to keep bringing that one up. I remember the 80s was a very random time. Like, you would have a fan in the 80s that, and I really miss it, by the way, that would love Michael Jackson, George Michael, Cyndi Lauper, Prince, AC/DC, Ozzy Osbourne, Run DMC,
yeah,
Beastie Boys, LL Cool J, and then their movie taste would be E.T. and maybe something sadder or something else. And it seemed like it was one shot and varied on what you would like, and there was no real clicks. And now it's like we have to customize our playlist. So if I log on Netflix and I like Marvel movies, it goes, watch Black Panther, watch Luke Cage, watch Jessica Jones. Mm-hmm. Well, I might want a movie from Tarkovsky, you know, like the original Solaris 72. I might want a Stanley Kubrick documentary. If I watch one of those, it'll suggest it. But where is that type of thing where you go to a bookstore and you go, well, that book cover looks interesting? That's disappearing. So everybody wants to go to a bestseller list, which I think kind of crushes the joy of discovering books. And we go to Rotten Tomatoes and Collider, and they tell us the bestsellers for movies, which is what I think this podcast is about, is this conditioning and sameness, which as a fanboy I enjoy, but that's only like 4 or 5 events a year out of like 100 or 200 entertainment events I give myself a year. Whereas I'd hate to be a fan that just fanboys on those things. Like there's other, maybe as a wrestling fan, you like the WWE for their big stuff, but then you also like all the minor circuits and smaller circuits, including, or Mexican circuits, who knows? Like maybe your horizons are broadened as opposed to like fans that are conditioned to like this one thing.
No, you make a good point with the music taste from the 80s. You know, you look at the top 40 charts, and in the 80s you would have hip-hop, or the emerging hip-hop, R&B, rock, adult contemporary, all within a weekly top 40 list. You look at a list now, and it's pretty much all
pop,
one or
music,
two pop and R&B, basically.
And it does, and this grumpy old man statement here, but I don't think even structurally they sound that much different. They kind of sound the same. There's like dancey stuff, there's hip-hop stuff about partying in the club, and there's kind of ballads, and they're not that much different. In fact, some of these artists sing on each other's records. They don't sound that much different to me.
They don't sound different, and it's, you know, not to go political, but everything seems to be segregating. Everything is labeled these days to where there is, not that there's no thought, but it's like it's trying to pinpoint exactly like you said, oh, you like this, so you automatically like this as well. You know, if you watch this movie, you're going to want to watch this movie. If you listen to this CD, you want to hear this band. And I know my tastes are very different. That 9 times out of 10 is not the case.
Mm-hmm.
And actually having this conversation about Netflix at work the other day, where they took away their 5-star rating system, which I didn't realize.
Hmm.
And so now instead of rating movies, it is, well, you watch this movie, so now you want to watch this one.
Yeah.
And like, no, I watched the new David Spade movie just because I didn't realize there was a new David Spade movie. I wanted to see how bad it was.
Yeah.
Not like I'm watching going, this is the greatest movie ever. So don't recommend, you know, Joe Dirt 2 to me because I don't actually want to watch that.
Yeah, it's conditioning you so that you're used to what you're watching. This could be your argument against sequels. And we're supposed to sit in the chair and have an auto playlist and hitting all of the things that we like. That's fine. There's people that definitely have their genres. Like, so if you're into Westerns, you might like that algorithm on Netflix. Hey, I didn't see this John Ford movie, and I didn't see this Jimmy Stewart movie with Anthony McMahon, Quinn, whatever. I'm losing my place on that one. But and I like some of those recommendations, but what about a list saying, surprise me? What about one graph saying, out of left field, you haven't watched a documentary in a while? Or maybe it doesn't have to be something you would hate, but it could be like, hey, this is a notable documentary, and out of left field, we think you should watch it. Or maybe don't suggest anything at all. I could turn that off, mm-hmm. and I'll find it myself. See, the real joy in discovering stuff is not having someone tell you what to watch or say, by the way, you watched this, and they'll only show you what they think you should watch next. The real joy is like my friends telling me, watch this, or I'll read an essay or some kind of review on something. This could be a topic for another podcast, but I like going back and watching older movies because that will really blow your mind. So I'm very familiar with the 70s, my favorite decade of cinema. 80s, the dawn of the blockbuster, which I know we're going to do a podcast, two-part series at some point, if we can actually tackle how crazy that decade was for how high impact these movies were to our childhoods. And then 90s, not my favorite. 2000s, I know all these decades, but if you start going back and watching Cary Grant movies and silent films, and then we're talking about foreign films, opens up a whole new door. How come people aren't going back and doing that? Like, if you like James Bond, well, then watch the old ones. I mean, if you like Westerns, watch one from the 50s. So sometimes when I talk to people, it's like, it's all about what's new. Mm-hmm. And Netflix produces a lot of original content. A lot of it's garbage. There's Westerns that are out. They're never as good as the old ones. And I can say that without even in an objective argument. It's very simple to prove that. The Westerns had their peak a while ago. There's some cool ones that are made from time to time. But the genre really peaked, much like superhero movies might be peaking now. We don't know. But why not, if you like sequels and you like genres, why don't you go back and see what started them all? Why don't you watch, I know people that like, the newer kids that like the prequels for Star Wars. And they don't even really care about the old ones. And I find that odd, you know. So you can also go back and discover stuff. It doesn't always have to be about what's being recommended now.
And I think, obviously, it's, you know, whenever you see something, that age is going to be important into your opinion mm-hmm. of it. And that's why I think kids that were, you know, between the ages of 5 and 12 when the Star Wars prequels came out probably enjoyed them and didn't find Jar Jar annoying.
No, they love it.
Like the way the people who grew up with the original trilogy did, because they had less of a attachment to the original. And I mean, I have no stats to prove what I'm about to say.
Those are my favorite.
But I do think that we are in a time where the past is not perceived as important in a way. Or you watch something from the past that, you know, by today's standards is not politically correct. And then it's all of a sudden, well, this is bad and we shouldn't even acknowledge its existence.
That makes it even more fascinating. So if you watch stuff now, you can see how either it's watered down or it's changed course, and in many cases rightly, because of these transgressions or these cultural issues in the past. But why would you want to know that? Like, so when you watch a movie that's from the 50s that may have something inappropriate in it, I'm not saying I seek these out, but if I see these moments, I'm like, wow, like that's the way it was back then. It's a historical thing. You can't put that away. No. Like Disney killing Songs of the South is horrible and stupid. Like, I'm not saying promote the DVD, mm-hmm. but you can't pull it from the Walt Disney Library, which they did.
And pretend it never existed.
Yeah, like that is hugely important. Like, that might be more important than everything else they've done put together. And I think, going back to your past thing, if you're a Star Wars nut, so apologize right. for this, but I totally get why kids would have their formative experiences being the ones from the 90s or whatever. But those movies are completely out of context if you don't have you haven't seen the other ones. So those they're okay stories, I guess, if you're younger, but they really kind of rely on you seeing what happens later down the line. Mm-hmm. So from those older ones being not as important in their eyes, to me is odd, you know? Because if I'm a Harry Potter fan and say there's 20 years, there's more Harry Potter stories, I'd want to know where it all started. You know, that's the whole... Godfather 3 means nothing if you haven't seen 1 and 2, and Godfather 3 is a horrible sequel. But, like, it only hangs off of your like for the other ones. So, if you're into Star Wars and you Anakin Skywalker turns into this, well, don't you want to see what he really turned into? After he even got worse than that. Yeah. You know, wait till you go farther.
Yeah, and that's, you know, we mentioned the Fantastic Beasts movie coming out later this year, which are, I guess, somewhat sequels to the Harry Potter franchise.
Yeah.
Even though they take place, I guess,
back in time before, in America.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I have only seen the first five Harry Potter movies, so I did not read the last book all the way through, mm-hmm. so I don't know how that story ends. But yeah, I would not expect to go into. I'm sure there's stuff in Fantastic Beasts that if I was really familiar with the Harry Potter story, I would get more context out of the Fantastic Beasts movies. Whereas if I just go in blind, I can probably hopefully still enjoy it as what it is, but that layer is removed because I don't have that knowledge.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a good point. That's another, I don't want to sidetrack too long on this because it would be a whole new podcast, but we talked about, I think before we were recording this, that it's impossible to go to a movie theater and be objective. I don't know where that started. It's not true. We go in there and our energy level is going to be this or that. The people we're with could be cool. They could be uptight. The crowd could be lame. The movie could really surprise you. It could be kind of what you expected. You could have high expectations. It can disappoint. You could have low expectations. It can be great. Like, I watched Quiet Place recently. People were raving about that movie. I saw it. I was like, I don't know what the deal is. I could break it down and tell you factually why I just do not think it's a very good movie. But I see why people liked it. I just can't see how it made that much money. So,
well,
I posted about it, but I don't want to trash it endlessly because people enjoyed it.
And would you say...
But it's an original movie that didn't work for me.
Part of the reason why it did well was because it was original.
I agree. I think that's a huge thing, is that you hadn't seen that type of movie before. And maybe that's the thirst that you're talking about. The audiences aren't getting quenched.
And so when something actually original comes along that is good, and I don't know how big of a star John Krasinski and Emily Blunt are, but it does have some name brand recognition with the people involved. Whereas going back to Eighth Grade, you know, it was written and directed by Bo Burnham, who I like as I don't even like calling him a comedian, more of a performance artist.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't tell you who's in the movie. I believe the father is a known actor.
I like that I don't know who's in that movie. So I don't want to think, oh, John Krasinski is the dad.
Mm-hmm.
That was my problem with Quiet Place, is that I didn't think he was very good in it. Emily Blunt, I just like in everything.
Okay.
So she disappears in roles. She's like, John Krasinski, that's another thing. But.
Well, and I'll tease a possible future episode. The other day I was watching a movie called Cedar Rapids.
Mm.
Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it.
I'd never heard of I think after I started watching it that I vaguely remember hearing about it, but I didn't know anything about it. So that's why I put it on. And it stars Ed Helms, John C. Reilly, Anne Heche. It's about an insurance convention in Cedar Rapids. Obviously, it has $100 million blockbuster written all over it.
Oh, yeah, franchise.
You know, yeah. But no, it was good, although my problem was Ed Helms was playing Ed Helms. John C. McGinley is playing John C. McGinley. I think we're lacking actors now where we just have personalities.
Yeah, American casting typically is not very risk-taking. And in some of these smaller movies, if you call them smaller, like Cedar Rapids, these guys are getting paid so much money, it's ridiculous. Like, I bet you that budget was probably $10, $15, $20 million. Mm-hmm. So is it really a small movie? Is Ed Helms probably getting a million or two? And then he's got to play a shtick. He's got to play himself. And I think what's missing, this is another podcast, but what's missing from American acting is the play and stage background. So that is at a high level in the UK and abroad, where all the actors, including the young, everyone's like, oh my God, they're always stealing our jobs and they're the best actors, and they're always the best actors. But it's because they have this huge dramatic background where they have to play the toughest roles continuously where they know their lines for hours, even as kids, and they have to be able to meld into any character, and everyone's watching them going, how good of an actor is this person? Whereas here, it's like, you look fat, you look funny, you got the part. Mm-hmm. You're Ed Helms. We've seen your shtick before. You're Brad Pitt even played off of his It Boy status, but even he was an It Boy for a while. So Keanu Reeves is getting a little typecast now as some kind of late action star. So Clint Eastwood wasn't exactly taking chances. He was squinting and shooting people. So I think that's what's missing. And that plays into our whole conversation about sequels, is that even our actors, like Tom Cruise has been Tom Cruise for so long. If you told me that the character he played in Cocktail flew a fighter jet and fought Russia, landed the jet, and then started running on rooftops, I would totally buy that. I'd go, that's Tom Cruise doing the exact same thing in different movies. So we'll see what happens tonight. But there's a sameness even to the actors we cast in these sequels.
And then occasionally the actor will take a chance. Tom Cruise, for example, in Magnolia. And they get...
Oh, yeah. He's pretty good in that.
They get rave reviews for going against type. But then those are usually in smaller movies where they don't make as much. And then if you want... You know, it's like Ben Affleck and Will and Matt Damon said in Jane Silent Bob Strikes Back. You do the blockbuster film first, and then you do the whatever they call it, the fun film or the passion project.
Yeah.
So you make your money up front, and then you go have fun.
Then you lose money on some project that nobody sees, a Gigli or whatever it is.
Yeah, and still never saw Gigli, but...
I haven't seen it. Did Kevin Smith make that?
No.
Okay.
No, he was making Jersey Girl when Gigli came out.
That's another conversation. I love Kevin Smith, the nerd icon and Comic-Con hero that he is. And all my thoughts are for him, because I know he had a huge health scare lately. He's lost a lot of weight. Proud of him. Can't stand his movies. Oh, my goodness. But they're original. They're mostly original. He's played off a couple of them.
You know, he's making Jay and Silent Bob reboot.
Oh, maybe I shouldn't have said that.
I think that's a good point to end this conversation. So, yes, I think this was a great conversation.
It was really good.
Again, we just kind of take topics and go off and see where the conversation leads. We'll be back next month with another installment with Eric and talking some other form of pop culture breakdown. But next week, tune in to edition of Question, I should say, Everything. Episode 55, Positive Cynicism, will be Question Everything with Travis Yates, who was on a previous episode discussing the Mr. Rogers phenomenon. And he just published his first book. He has had a dog that had a seizure that couldn't walk. And they put the dog through therapy and got it, I guess, walking again. I've not read the book in full yet, but if you're interested, we'll throw a link up on the Facebook page, Positive Cynicism, and PositiveCynicism.com. So if you want to buy that book. And then at the end of the month, Mike DeKalb will be back for another Wonder Why edition, and we're calling it the 90s Lilith Fair edition. We'll either be breaking down Meredith Brooks's Bitch, Joan Osborne's One of Us, or... Sean Colvin's Sonny Came Home. So tune in for that. But until next episode, as always, question everything, do something positive.
This is a production of the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. For more jittery shenanigans, go to jitterymonkey.com.